NPR Music is celebrating 10 years, and we're looking back at some moments and some memories. It's 2011. I'm Bob Boylan, here with Jacob Gans and Ann Powers, and this is James Blake. A record full of restraint. This is something we talked about a little bit with the XX a handful of years earlier, steeped in electronica, but also the music of his dad, which is a cover song. This is called Wilhelm Scream. It's a cover song. It's a cover of his own father's song that he did, a song called Where to Turn. His father was very steeped in music of Sam Cooke and lots of blues and so forth. Just a beautiful, beautiful, beautiful record.
It's like soul coming from inside a computer, like way deep down inside a computer.
There was so much great electronica that was coming out in those years, and James Blake seemed to bring sort of the compositional skills using things like Ableton, things that where music was not as linear as it once was.
You mean it sounded like it had been chopped up?
Yes, absolutely. You know, when you record on tape, you do something at the beginning and has a middle, has an end, and it's one linear. You literally can hold the tape and touch the beginning and touch the end. But with computer programs like Ableton, things could come up randomly. Sounds and effects could change at random. And it was much less a sense of a verse, chorus, and all that stuff in music. And
or for people who are using it in innovative ways, that was sort of built into what they were doing, yeah. But another thing that he did that I feel like you didn't quite get before music was being made entirely inside a computer was those incredible, incredible, deep, deep, deep bass notes and the glitchiness and total silence in some cases, right? Like, there's no tape hiss, everything just drops out. It really sounds like it's coming from a void.
You don't think we got that in hip-hop before James Blake, Jacob?
I think that we did. I think that's a really good point. Maybe the thing that's different in the music that he's making, and similarly to the XX, although I think he's taking it to a more austere, lonelier place, given that he's making so much of this music by himself, is that the sound of the machine that he's making it in is almost more important in some ways than his own voice. I mean, there's a competition there for sure. But in hip-hop, I feel like there's a lot of taking advantage of that technology and not as much foregrounding the technology itself.
I think in Drake's music, you get something similar. And of course, Take Care came out in 2011, too.
That's a good point. Those records pair very well together.
Also in this year, in 2011, we had a record by Adele. And
pretty much the opposite of James Blake in some ways, wouldn't you say? A woman whose quote-unquote natural talent brought us back to a sound of Motown or classic soul, but her delightful British personality captivated the world. And it was interesting with Adele because 21, of course, represented her at 21, was a massive commercial hit, but it wasn't her debut. She'd been around for a little while, had a previous album, and this was the breakthrough. This is when she ran out from the pack of contenders. There were all these young women singers who were sort of vying for that spot, like Rumor and Duffy. They all had single names for some reason, but Adele completely claimed it.
Let's hear this from Adele's 21. As I listen to this and as I think of James Blake, I think of like, all right, if James Blake is, at least voice-wise, let's put texture aside for a moment, is 1963, 1961 Sam Cooke, you know? It really is. At least that's what he worked up. That's how he tried to find his voice, was through that music. This is 1964 and 5 Motown.
I was going to say it's the Supremes. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's just, they're not, they're American soul.
Yep.
Yeah, right. American soul has so much effect on British music, and the way it comes back at us decade after decade after decade is always just wonderful. I love
I think I called it green-eyed soul, Adele's breakthrough music. It was, you know, there's a lot of questions about whether white performers have a right to partake of African-American traditions. It's truly inevitable, in my opinion, since all American music is African-American music, and much British music, too. But something about the way Adele communicates it, twists it a little bit, changes the tone, changes the tint.
I was just thinking about almost exactly that same thing. Like, if you listen to that song, it's not the drums and it's not the vocals, it's not the backing vocals. Like, what is it in that song that makes it a 2011 record instead of a 1965 record? Is it the bass, or is it just
I think it's the production, it's the compression, you know, it's actually probably not that far from what makes James Blake music unique. And this is not an album that was recorded in Sharon Jones of the Dap Kings style, you know, all analog or anything like that. But then also her voice, which embodies a new generation of women who are confronting all of the basic issues in their own ways. You know, sometimes what's new is really just a turn of what's always been with us. And I think that's the truth with Adele.
And I want to come back right after a quick break and talk about the passing of Amy Winehouse and how that all connects.
Support for NPR Music's 10th anniversary and the following message come from iZotope, makers of Spire Studio, the portable multi-track recording system that lets you easily capture, mix, and edit professional quality songs wherever and whenever inspiration strikes. With built-in Wi-Fi, Spire Studio seamlessly connects to the Spire app, so you can ditch the cables to collaborate and share with bandmates and fans around town or around the world. Learn more at spire.live.
I'm Bob Boylan. I'm here with Jacob Gans and Ann Powers. It's 2011, everybody. And by the way, there's deep, deep links to so many of the memories from the past 10 years of NPR Music on our webpage. And it's fun to explore, so I suggest going and doing that. Jacob, you've been working on this for a while.
Yeah, we didn't try to do a comprehensive list of everything that happened in the last 10 years. It would be impossible. And 2007 to 2017, it's a random chunk of time, right? So we picked out things that we care about as a group, as individuals, things that we remember, things that stick with us, things that have changed in the time since they happened. It's been a totally fascinating process looking at what everybody remembered from that period.
Yeah, in fact, sometimes there are things like Bandcamp starts in 2008, and you just don't realize what that would mean. So it's fun to look back and see the impact that small things at the time had down the line. We were talking about Adele just before the break. This is the year Amy Winehouse passed away.
Yeah, that was a serious blow and definitely a shock, although not completely unexpected. Amy Winehouse, one of the great voices of the 21st century, so young when she died, but had been on a path, a troubled path for quite a while. I remember so vividly, I was riding in the car with my family from upstate New York to New York City when I heard the news that she had died. And I wrote my entire remembrance of her in the car on my phone. What that says to me is not, oh, that I'm such an amazingly efficient writer on a phone, but that Amy's death sadly was something we kind of knew was coming. She exemplified a certain spirit that was so beautiful but burned so hard and so fast that when we lost her, we weren't ready, but we were also not totally shocked.
She did a thing with soul music that was a little bit different from what Adele had done. And when Amy Winehouse landed a few years earlier, around the same time that Adele put 19 out, Adele was really she was riding Amy Winehouse's coattails, right? Like, this was the year that the divergence between the two of them was never starker. But it's really worth remembering just what a insanely unique individual she was in terms of songwriting, in terms of her delivery, bringing hip-hop into soul, bringing some real vulgarity into soul music. I think that that's one of the things that I'll remember.
This is a record that, I mean, again, this is England and the U.S. and soul, where here's a British singer that comes to America, basically, and records in Daptone studio. And this record came out, what, in 2006? But I think made as much impact after she died, more people became aware of her. Would that be fair to say?
I don't know. I think that she had been absent from the scene a little bit before she died. She had been on this downward path. So there was a space filled, as Jacob suggested. From within that space, Adele emerged. It is a question, I think. Like, would Adele have been able to have the 21 moment had Amy Winehouse been in full health? Because really, there was a strange kind of like competition among all these young women to fill Amy Winehouse's high-heeled shoes. And it was weird. Women shouldn't have to compete like that over the top spot. But I do feel like there's a sense that Adele moved into Amy Winehouse's space and occupied it in a whole new way. Do you think that's fair?
I mean, I think that once you start thinking about all of the different ways that that's unfair, I mean, you can make an argument that it's unfair, but that really is how it felt at the time. I mean, especially when Back to Black came out and in the years after, when you started thinking about sort of like the soul revival, that British soul revival, as something that was this retro moment and maybe would just pass. Back to Black became something that lasted, and Adele turned that moment into something that lasted. It wasn't a given in the specific moment in 2006 or 2007 when those records were coming out, but I think that those two albums are the lasting effect of that time period for very different reasons and with very different legacies.
Yes, and I just must add, though, that Beyoncé put out 4 this same year, 2011, and so R&B, American R&B, African-American R&B was also in a fascinating place. And I was just listening to her song Countdown today and thinking about how that song fits in exactly with what Amy Winehouse was doing, with what Adele was doing. And yet it's also, I think, more of a vocal challenge than maybe either of them could match. So we also see Beyoncé continuing her rise to the absolute queendom that she occupies today.
And not to forget the Alabama Shakes.
Oh, yes, and the Alabama Shakes, my favorites. And yeah, that's a new voice we hear, Brittany Howard, who's not, you know, not necessarily a soul artist, but an artist who combines classic rock with blues, with singer-songwriter traditions, and really becomes someone that people love and are so attracted to and so identify with, and still today is making just better and better music with everything she touches.
One of the cool things about 2011 was the very beginning of, if you didn't know who Amy Winehouse was and she passed, you could then just go and listen to her music for basically free. Maybe a few ads will pop up on your screen, because 2011 is the beginning of Spotify here in the U.S. It's a Swedish company.
Yeah, it had launched a few years earlier in Europe and had sort of spread throughout Europe. Spotify was launched in Sweden as basically a cure for piracy. Piracy in Sweden was even more rampant than it was in the United States. It was basically invented or sold as as a cure for the idea that people wanted music for free, that there would be all these licensing deals behind the scenes, that you would listen to some ads or you would pay a subscription, and then musicians would get royalties as a result of all of that listening, not from buying. When it launched in the United States in 2011, it was sold on a couple of principles to listeners as the idea that you could listen to any song from all time, from all of history, at the click of a button. All you had to do was search for it, and you could click and play. And then sort of on this other principle that that it would be paying royalties to people who had whose royalties or whose income had diminished as a result of piracy or the downturn in CD sales, which could be blamed on some other factors as well. There were issues with both of those things when Spotify launched, right? The idea that you could listen to anything from all time was dependent on Spotify having a contract with the owners of that music. Not all of it was actually on Spotify. Not all of it is still on Spotify. There are still things that you can't find. The Beatles held out for a long time. And then concerns about royalties and how much people were actually getting paid was an issue right from the beginning with Spotify. Indie labels were up in arms at the fact that Spotify had basically made deals first with the major labels who owned part of the company, and they were afraid that they would not have as big a seat at the table and wouldn't get the same royalties that major labels do. Royalties are still an issue with streaming. Mm-hmm. Musicians complaining that they don't get a fair cut of what the income that the company gets. You know, Spotify is a huge company that has still never declared that it's made a profit. So, you know, Spotify has been a complicated company, but it's like absolutely without question, the thing that's happened between 2011 and 2017 is that it's become the way we listen to music.
It totally has knocked the iTunes monopoly out and sort of invented the way we get. It's not that we're not downloading things anymore. We're not buying things for the most part anymore.
Yeah, I mean, for the most part, people still buy CDs. Some people. People still buy MP3s. Some people. But
people buy vinyl.
People buy vinyl. Very few people actually still buy vinyl. You know, I think the thing that we're going to remember in the period before 2011, the 10 or 15 years that led up to that, is that there was this transitional period where people actually owned MP3s. This technology that liberated music, or at least the digital files that contain music, from a physical product. Streaming services like Spotify, like Apple Music, that's the end point of that. As far as we can tell right now, there will surely be a development in the future. But the MP3 that you buy, I think, is going to kind of end up being the 8-track of this period, right? Like a thing that liberates music from the way that you had to listen to it in the past on a turntable in your home, puts it in a car or puts it in something that you can carry, before it becomes obsolete because something better is invented, or the way that that thing is actually supposed to happen gets invented.
Chip implant.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
You know, for me, the weirdest thing that's happened since Spotify started is the archival impulse that it fulfilled for me, that exciting experience of sitting down with my Spotify app and saying, I'm going to explore gospel from the 1940s. I'm going to explore prog rock from Germany in the 1970s. Really, that's how I used Spotify initially. But since the playlists have really taken over the Spotify experience, for me, I have to remind myself that that's what I loved about Spotify. And I fear that the active kind of interface that many people experience through Spotify has given way to really a different version of radio, but mm-hmm. without even the personalities that guided us through radio and made us feel like we at least had a connection and had some choice, like we like this DJ, so we choose this station. Now there's just the algorithm, and the algorithm to me feels very scary, like a drug or like a kind of invisible treadmill that we're all on. So I guess that's my dystopian view of where Spotify has taken us.
There are some people who are making those playlists. There are people who are behind the scenes. You don't hear their voices very much. I mean, if one of the things you liked about the radio and the people who were delivering you the pop music, even if it was all the same playlist as the same kind of station one town over, at least you heard a person's voice delivering that stuff. But there are people who are making the Rap Caviar playlist on Spotify. But yeah, I mean, it's a very narrow stretch of songs that gets delivered to most people every month. The archiving impulse, the deep dive impulse is really not there. All the songs in the whole world boil down to like 40 songs a month for most people.
Right, boil down to whatever Selena Gomez is up to this month.
Other things in 2011 as we wrap up here. Go.
I have a big one. Ann Powers started working for NPR Music. That was pretty huge for me.
That's awesome.
That was huge for me too. Wyoke put out its album Civilian. Toon Yards put out Who Kill. Destroyer put
PJ
out...
PJ Harvey, Let England Shake.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, that was a good one. The first Frank Ocean mixtape, or the first Frank Ocean mixtape that people heard, Nostalgia Ultra. Drake's Take Care came out that year. My favorite album of 2011, Shabazz Palace's Black Up. That was a great one.
Kate Bush began her comeback with 50 Words for Snow that led to her long run of shows in England and brought her back, I think, to everyone's consciousness, which was exciting.
My favorite album that year was this weird King Creosote and John Hopkins record called Diamond Mine that I just still to this day is one of my favorite albums of the century. And in my lifetime, I just madly love that record.
Wow, that's beautiful. I love that one of your favorite records of your lifetime came out in 2011.
Yeah, me too. Thanks, everybody. We're going to go on. We'll do. There's going to be a podcast over the course of 2 weeks. There's going to be a podcast for every year from 2007 up to 2016. And then, of course, our 2017 coverage will begin on NPR Music's website. And we'll have album picks from listeners and our writers here. So go look and see what we have, because there's a lot of fun things to jog your memories from the past.
Thanks, you guys.
Thanks, Dan.
For NPR Music, it's All Songs Considered. I won't let you fall. It's low.